Hi everyone, Lucas Werner here. If you've been enjoying these conversations with artists, I invite you to come visit David's Werner Gallery exhibitions in person. We're located in New York, Los Angeles, London, Paris, and Hong Kong. New exhibitions open each month. Plan your visit at davidswerner.com.
I'm Jordan Wolfson, and I'm a friend to myself.
I'm Jeremy O'Harris, and I'm a playwright. Yeah.
From David's Werner, this is Dialogues, a podcast about artists and the way they think.
Yeah, but I always felt like that transgression led to transformation. Do you know what I mean? In all hero tale, right? Like go to any Jungian story, like there's this point where the hero goes through a sort of transgressive situation to come out renewed. And in a way, like we're giving that to the viewer.
Blackness and brownness are refracted in more exciting ways in the visual art world because there's just been more license for us to be like, you know, you see William Pope Appel and you're like, oh, like this is the abject blackness that I feel.
I'm Lucas Werner, and every episode features a conversation. We're taking artists, writers, philosophers, designers, and musicians and putting them in conversation with each other to explore what it means to make things today. This episode's pairing, the artist Jordan Wolfson and the playwright Jeremy O'Harris.
Maybe we just start by hearing a little bit how you, Jeremy, and you, Jordan, how you guys first met or what the context was, how you saw each other's work. I'm sort of curious how that came about.
Did we meet online before we met IRL? Or
no. We met, okay, I know how we met, was that I was with Hari Neff, and we were literally walking from that restaurant Lucien to the Bowery Hotel, and we passed by a poster for Daddy, and she was like, this is the play I'm in. And this guy, Jeremy, said, he's a fan of your work. I go, really? And then she says, yeah, he said that if he was a contemporary artist, he would have wanted to make real violence.
Yeah.
And when I heard that, I was so flattered. And then it just stayed with me. I said, wow, that's like the kindest thing someone could say. And then I was in New York and I asked Hari, could I come and see the play? And I went with Linda Norden and the play Daddy. And I thought it was so powerful. And I was so amazed by it. And then for some reason, 8 days later, I'm in Los Angeles. I meet you at a party.
At Chris's house.
At Chris's house. And I'm like, oh, hey. And then somehow I realized it was you. And then you realized it was me. And then we just like snuck back into a room and just like talked.
We talked. And then we started watching the Michael Jackson documentary.
Yeah, we started watching the Michael Jackson documentary.
Which is real violence, honestly.
Yeah.
At the party.
At the party, yeah. Like before we went to another party.
We were like in this very dark room at the party and there was like this one of those photographs of Robert Mapplethorpe of the female bodybuilder.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there was a sex swing in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're like sitting on the bed. And then, yeah.
But my sort of question, the first one is, if that's how, I mean, assuming that's how something that you did indeed say, what was the reason, I mean, when you think about real violence, what drew you to the piece? What was it about that kind of made you say, okay,
yeah,
if I were making visual art, this would be the kind of thing. Because that was divisive, that piece at the Whitney was complicated for many people, but amazing. Yeah. And I'm curious what...
Well, I think that it's so funny because like, I feel so naked right now. Because I was like, oh God, like I didn't know she told you that. But it's. I think that what it is that like I'm very into immersing people inside of discomfort, or at least that's a part of something I'm interested in. And I think that like what was exciting to me about the whole experience of real violence was that like as violent as it was, it like was so actively like articulating itself as a fiction, like a fiction that you're like witnessing and engaging with, and yet like it confronted you with like with the like inconceivability of like some fictions, right? And I liked how like for some people like it's like inconceivable that like you would have to witness this fiction, even though like it's a fiction that like we see in a lot of different forms in a lot of different places. And I don't know, it's the kind of, for me, what makes art exciting are things that have so much rigor in them that like you have to pick them apart for days and hours, and the rigor is in all these different forms of labor. And so I don't know, I got really excited by that.
What did you think of Jordan act? I mean, that was one of the things that drew me in, is to see Jordan. You know, you could have done that piece, Real Violence, with an act, you know, with a sort of like obviously violent personality as someone who sort of like really presents that way. But of course, Jordan doesn't really present as a sort of a bat wielding killer.
No. But he does have sociopathy in his eyes, which I'm into.
And what about you, Jordan? What, when you talked about, because we talked about the play and you were talking about different aspects of it that really moved you. And I'm curious to hear a little bit more about that.
So I wanted to go to the play mostly to support Hari. And I was just curious about Jeremy. And I went to the play, and if I may say so myself, if I was a playwright, this is what I would want to be doing. And I thought, oh my God, genius. I just thought, so brilliant. And there was formal broad strokes, texture. It was this use of pop that I really felt like I related to, as like pop as a gesture, pop as an abstraction, pop as a distortion, where you're actually taking something that's like made and then you're putting it there and it creates a distortion around it because of its use. Like by using like the kind of colloquial use within the theater format of like a piece of music, for example, like Rihanna or George Michael, creates a kind of vacuum of a kind of distortion for me, which had a kind of like a completely fresh gestalt. And it was just terrific. And I saw also in Jeremy's work someone really dealing with form and composition in terms of chronology, which is something that's very, very close to me as well. So one of the things, if you haven't seen Daddy, is so basically there's this whole dream sequence, almost like a nightmare sequence in the play. And it's kind of like, as Jeremy sort of was talking about Real Violence, it's incredibly uncomfortable, potentially like 35 minutes section where the character completely becomes introspective. And in many ways, it's the most unpleasant, incongruous part of the play. But there's no way the play could have worked without it. And it was like, it was almost as if like you were driving down a highway, the road was smooth, the road is perfect, but then in order to get where you want to go to the other highway, you have to take like this treacherous dirt road, bumpy path to get back to the other road. And that's how I felt about it when I saw it. And I just appreciated that so much. And I appreciated Jeremy's rigor. And then when I met him, I was, you know, if you meet Jeremy, you're totally dazzled by this man. He's so wonderful. So I got really, really excited about the whole thing. And I feel like with everything that like all this like virtue signaling and like politically correct stuff, that I just was like, I just felt like I just wanted to see culture. Like I want to see the world, and I want it to be like uncensored, and I want to be free to comment on it and know that like the gallery space, or for you, the theater space, is a safe space to express ideas, and they're not like actual actions against people, blah, 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 blah. And I just felt with like Jeremy, I was like, oh my God, kindred spirits. Like this is what we're supposed to be doing. We're not supposed to be like helping someone make a moral message that like reinstates their value fears.
Yeah. Yeah, and a value system that like is already codified, so codified that like it's you don't learn something if it's already codified, right? Like, so why engage with it? You know, there's, I don't know, I don't want to like name any things, but there are a lot of things that I'm just like, why, like Norman Lear said this better in 67. You know what I mean? Like, why are we still like reifying something that's like already like there and better and more transgressive? And I think that like it's also funny, I love that you talked about pop and myself, because I think what I like a lot about your work is that there's such a sense of play that like there's never a feeling that like the person making this is actually a sadist, which I think is something that, or actually someone who's like so in love with their own privilege that they're just like provoking for provocation's sake. There like seems to be like a real joy inside of what's happening, even when it's like dark or like even titling real violence, when it's like a VR film. It's like there's already like an inlaid joke there, right?
Yeah.
That like you're inviting people to laugh or like inviting people to like move differently with this piece than if you had called it like. If you had named it after the prayer, right? Like,
right.
If you had named it after the prayer, then it would have been this, like, sort of, like, deeply dark, like, I think, like, a more dark thing. There would have been no play there.
And the prayer was so weird that I did that, but I really remember trying to record it myself and trying to do it without it. And I was like, without it, it's just too dry.
Yeah.
But then I had basically the idea for the prayer was that it, like, cuts out in the middle. And cutting out in the middle, the message, the formal message of cutting in the middle was like, it's not about the prayer and the prayer is not important.
Yeah.
That the prayer was a formal device.
Yeah.
That was it. And then the thing flips and flips and flips. But it's similar to like the structure of Daddy, that you had to get through something to get somewhere else. And I think a lot of artists like aren't willing to take that risk because they don't have enough confidence in their viewer. And I think that's why I feel connected to Jeremy. I hope you feel the same way.
100%. It's actually I'm on this really intense Norman Lear kick right now because I they did that recent like live like, you know, thing, and then my grandpa died like a week after that, and my grandpa is such a like Archie Bunker like sort of like George Jefferson kind of character that I was like, oh, let me like rewatch these shows and see what's going on. And like the rigor of his politic at that time and like the unabashed like fearlessness of what he was saying and how he was saying it and the fact that it was popular, like the most popular shows on television, mm-hmm. like tells me so much about like my own feelings that like audiences get things, you know, like I'm a consultant on this show called Euphoria, and then like watching all the critics sort of like tiptoe around what their actual opinion is of the show inside of their review. They're all giving non-reviews because I think they're waiting to see what the internet's gonna say before they like either champion it or deny it. Because they're like, oh, like they have to virtue signal. They're like, guys, I don't know if kids can take this. Like, it's really scary. Blah blah. I'm like, were you never a teenager? Like, do you not remember like all the dark shit you imagined and all the dark shit you did and all the dark shit you hoped to do? You know what I mean? And I was like, and these kids, they're gonna eat this up. And it's not glamorizing it to say they're going to eat it up. They're just like going to be excited that someone's like representing part of their psyche in some way, shape, or form. And we're in this moment now where people are afraid to even make like tepid steps towards like transgression because there's so much fear that like some phantom trouble will come following you.
It's so crazy. It's so much fear. Everyone is sort of holding on, you know, to the seat and the table at the same time. And you just like, yeah, but I always felt like that transgression led to transformation.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? In all hero tale, right? Like go to any Jungian story, like there's this point where the hero goes through a sort of transgressive situation to come out renewed.
Exactly.
And that's the viewer. And in a way, like we're giving that to the viewer, you know, yes. In the gallery or in the theater.
Yeah. And also in music. I feel like we allow so much more transgression in music that I find it, even formal transgression that we don't allow in other places, which is why I like go to pop music a lot. Like I really love, like even thinking about, like I saw the Temptations musical the other day. And like even like, you know, the Papa with the Rolling Stone being like one of their biggest hits, it's like insane because like that song has like a 4-minute intro, like a funk intro, like which is like no one else had. And it was like, dun, 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 dun. And it's this weird sort of somber tale of like a deadbeat dad, and like that a great song does not generally make, or like a great pop song doesn't generally make, and it was like the biggest pop song ever, and it was because it felt different, it was new and alive, and like broke the rules of like all the things that people said about songs being 3 minutes or songs needing to sound like whatever the Beatles were doing at the time or etc. And I think about how like in the theater, especially in commercial theater, like the rules around what makes a play are so set in stone that like even formally, that like we've forgotten that like what makes Shakespeare exciting is that like when he writes a romance, his romance like doesn't follow all the rules that like Marlowe's romances had to follow. You know what I mean? And like, because he was like an experimentalist. Like Shakespeare, like if you read Cymbeline, you're like, what the fuck is this guy's doing? Like he's going back to like the Greeks and being like, and Jupiter comes in. You know, and you're like, wait, what? Jupiter just like jumps out and like does a Deus Ex Machina in the middle of this like war story you're telling. And I'm missing that in like the commercial theater space. Like this like relationship to form and transgression of form that like lead us to like new epiphanies inside of the work that we're watching and like different and a different emotive journey. Cause like if I know that like in the third act X is gonna happen, then like why would I like what am I getting out of that? But a lot of people actually prefer that engagement with art.
Feel safer. Feel more predictable.
Yeah, if your body knows it.
Exactly. You know, then you know what to predict. Yeah.
People are really looking with their bodies.
You know, the question of music, I wanted to hear a little bit more, Jordan, before we even had this conversation, you sort of said, I want to talk about the role of music in both of your work. You know, how did you, from the video work early on, what is the relationship to, I mean, how did you become interested in bringing pop music in? What is the sort of interruptive force? I find it can be very erotic in a way. It sort of like prepares you for a different experience in the thing. It's then also, it cuts out very abruptly in your work. I'm curious why and how you kind of put that in.
I think it's like this idea of, for me, I had this intuition about like this idea of like a one-to-one import from the world, you know, because I always feel like being an artist, like I'm like outside kind of the world. Like I'm not like part of mainstream culture. And it was like this idea of import from mainstream culture was a kind of abstraction. And then the less you do to it, the more radical you are. Like the less you change it, the more radical that import becomes, because by changing it, you're adding a kind of form value to it, right? Mm-hmm. That's like giving you a permission. But like by not changing it, it actually becomes more radical. And so with, for example, Raspberry Poser or Riverboat Song, this idea of just like taking it, and then when you take this thing and it kind of then sort of reflects over the sort of visual content qualities of the work, and then it kind of accelerates it and, I don't know, kind of moves it into a kind of another like frequency,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
And that was like kind of how I was thinking of it. And it's funny that you would think that something so known can be so like transporting. And so in Daddy, there's this scene, if you haven't seen it, where they do the father figure song, and it's just like a full on, I mean, I'd love you to talk about that.
I mean, it's so funny because you talked about being outside of mainstream culture. I feel so in mainstream culture, like so like embedded in it. Like I feel like, and it might be like the sort of like small difference in age, but like growing up with a computer, I've always felt like in the Matrix, you know? And so like part of my dramaturgy has always been like, oh, like I want to play to feel like the internet. So like, or how I engage with the internet. So like there's like a private window up with just like porn playing, and then there's like iTunes on, and like, you know, like every yeah, all the inputs of my day like happen inside of the place. Like you know, it'll go from like a Fred Moten essay I'm reading in my email to that. So it's like these things can all exist in the same place because they all exist right here on my phone.
So do you actually have all those things up at the same time?
Oh, 100%. I didn't bring my laptop, but I have way too many things on my.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I can focus on one thing at a time.
Oh wow.
And I can, like, if there's porn on my computer,
yeah,
like I have to like turn it off immediately because I like need to focus on I'm just like one thing of focus at a time. Or maybe I'll have like Photoshop and After Effects open.
Yes.
But there's never porn up. But also at the same time, like I work in a studio and I have employees. Yes. So like
but also like porn is also really great for, I love like just like not even like erotically watching porn, like watching porn for like just like what's happening in the world. Like what are people into? Like I love looking at the most popular videos in like different regions. And like also like when you going to like Berlin, like literally going to Pornhub in Berlin compared to going to Pornhub in London is so radical.
What are the differences?
I mean, like there's like just like a lot, like it's like Pornhub in Berlin is a lot more violent than Pornhub in like just like just naturally and casually violent, like in like a way. And like there's like the uploads are from things like there's what's the name of that, there's like this weird French brand of gay porn that like is like all these like Middle Eastern men with like huge dicks just like like finding guys that are just like wandering around like the city, and like, and then
they have that in straight porn as well. They're like, "Oh, can I help you?" Yeah,
and then they just like they beat up these guys.
They
and
beat
then,
them up.
Yes, and then they fuck them.
Oh, we don't have that with girls. We don't beat them up.
Oh, that's. Yeah. Don't know what you're missing. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, Dark. Anyway, but no, I think it like allows.
Isn't that interesting? Well, let's go back to that. Let's go back to. So, what does that mean in the storyline of that? They say we meet you.
Yeah,
and we transgress.
Yes,
and then we transform.
Yes, yes. I think the part of it is like, you know, there's a. I mean, I think it also has to do with the fact that like there's this like deep like eroticized fear of the Middle East in all of Europe, mainland Europe, but like I think that they've made an object of that fear, like an object that they can like fuck, and an object that they can like that can validate that fear, but also validates the erotic.
I think that's like similar to like in the same way that like Mel Brooks made The Producers, right? And like they, in order to process the Holocaust, like he had to make The Producers, and in order to process like potentially this facet of like xenophobia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like on the victim of xenophobia, that they process it through sexuality as well.
100%.
And humor.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting that processing through transgressive sexuality or processing through humor are more or less similar.
I think it's complete, and I think that that's the thing I accidentally stumbled into with Slave Play and Daddy, which is that like for me it's like it made perfect sense that like my relationship to white America is like a sort of like one that's like based in sort of like a dom sub like kink relationship.
Yeah.
Like it just like it has always felt that way. There's like an eroticized relationship, I think, between like a sort of psychic erotic relationship between like the white supremacy and like black bodies that goes unrecognized,
right,
and becomes like very obvious when you just like put it plainly in front of you. And so and for me it was just like that was always where my brain was, because I'm someone who's like watching like a Rihanna music video and then also has like I'm like, oh, like what porn is the most popular porn in New York this month, and then like seeing that like it's Ebony, you know, and I'm like, oh, that's
so
interesting.
So you can actually find out like within regions what the most popular
yes,
porn
is. It is psychotic.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, like Pornhub actually does a lot of really great like Pornhub and OkCupid do a lot of great like
data analytics.
Yeah, data analytics on like people's desire. Like, you know, the fact that like on OkCupid, the least attractive or the least like spoken to men are Asian men, and the least spoken to or attractive like people are black women is like really interesting. Like we now have like that statistic from OkCupid. Like they were just like, here's how people talk, and like the most talked to women are like Asian women, which is like great. It's like, you know, black men are pretty high too. They're like number two or something.
High to and not spoken to?
No, and spoken to.
And to spoken to.
Yeah.
You know, I was curious, you said, Jordan, that you focus on one thing, but there's definitely, the internet definitely feels present in your work, yeah, right? I mean, when you say you sort of import a pop song directly, there is, it's on the backdrop of a very interruptive, often kind of, you know, pastiched or almost manic set of images, you know, moving, edited very, very carefully, very deliberately. I mean, you must feel like it's kind of filtering in some way.
Yeah, but it also like that's also an import, you know, like that's like importing witnessing, the import of witnessing in a way for me, and I trust that like what I witness myself, like other people are witnessing as well. Like it's not just me who's bad, you know. It's not just me who's curious.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of like trust in that, and it's this idea of like importing. Like with Riverboat Song or this earlier piece called Favorite Things, the idea of importing like an internet search and like how an internet search can become like a portrait of you and your time.
Yeah.
For example.
In the editing though too, I mean, do you feel like that's witnessing, as it were, let's say like the internet as the way people are engaging with it? Do you see that in the sort of edit cutting process?
So the editing is also very compositional in terms of like deflecting any kind of potential message in a way that you deflect a message to create an overall gestalt or attitude, and that attitude can then be presented as a potential gesture. Or I would never want to use like an attitude as a message, but like, yeah, it's like I kind of start like butting, I butt things up together in a way that like doesn't work, and the sense that it doesn't work works because it's like you can draw within the line. If I start just drawing within the lines, it's already inside the viewer's body. But if I start drawing out of the lines, you start seeing the beauty of the color out of the lines. And that's kind of what the edit is as well. And the edit is like, the edit has a way I try and sort of access a kind of like naturalistic indifference even.
Yeah. I was going to ask about drawing inside and outside the lines and like things that are so wrong that they work in a way. Is that what drew you to Lady Gaga at all? Because I love the fact that you like sampled art pop, which is like
applause, applause.
Yeah, well, no, but it's from the art pop album, which is like her like.
Of course, no, but
because I'm a full on little monster.
I wanted to. Oh, I'm not. I'm not.
Oh, I am.
No, so I was like, let me try and think back of how I was. I thought, In the same way that you potentially saw like Rihanna's work, like if you take something literally from the present and abstract it, there's a kind of, it's also kind of radical. Rather than taking something from 20 years ago that's like nostalgic, mm-hmm. for example, that's like a little like, I mean, easier, whatever you want to say. And so for me, like, it's this idea of, like, I don't know, Jeremy, you chime in if you feel the same way, but, like, I feel like this idea of, like, being able to, like, okay, it's, like, not, I'm not saying this in a competitive way with anyone else but myself, and I'm not saying in a competitive way with any other artists or creatives, but, like, the idea to see it first. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by seeing it first is, like, there's, for example, like, art pop and you have the song Applause and it's just like in the world with us, but can you see it at a remove while it's still new? In its new, fresh, completely ripe present state, step to the side and witness it anew. Witness it. And that's what I'm trying to do in the work. And I hope that it kind of carries that frequency as it's kind of fixed in the work. For example, in Female Figure, the song Applause, which actually happens, I think it happens right after the first lines of the piece. And then it's actually followed by Paul Simon's Graceland.
I love that.
And then I took the Blurred Lines remix and I slowed it down. And then it ends with a clip of Leonard Cohen's Boogie Street.
Yeah.
Insane.
And but it's like this kind of macro to micro thing. And it's like in the same way that like the edit doesn't work, the content doesn't work, that their things are deflecting on each other. And then it's kind of potentially creating this space for the viewer to gain a kind of like in access to themselves as new. So the viewer can potentially see the world with me.
Yeah. No, I get, I mean, you just spoke so many things that articulated things that have been like impulses of mine forever that I'm just like, I don't know where the impulse comes from, but it's just like, one of the first things I did when I went to drama school early on was I would do like certain pop songs as monologues. So like the Lady Gaga, Disco Stick, I would like, and all my teachers would always be like, where's this monologue from? And I was like, it's from Lady Gaga. It's like a Lady Gaga song. Or it was like, you know, whatever. But like, but for me, I was always just like, no, like the reason this is ubiquitous is because like its form is perfect, basically. Like a lot of great pop songs like have perfect form and very perfect structure. And like, and it's like there's something true about it. Like even if it's like silly or vapid, there's something true about it. And you might miss that trueness when it's like, I wanna kiss you, but I'm not doing it. I might miss you, babe. It's like you might miss it then. But if someone is like, I wanna kiss you,
right?
And if I do, I might miss you, babe. It's complicated. It's stupid. Got my ass kissed by Sexy Cupid. I guess he wants to play. You know, I love game. You know, whatever. So like, it's like that was like my obsession. And I think like seeing someone do that. Now it's also it makes you think of like why like I'm really I have this like deep sadness that like sampling has overtaken covering, right? Like everyone samples and sampling is exciting, and like I think you and I sample a lot in our work, right? In the way that pop musicians do now, but no one does covers anymore, like just pure covers. And I think when we do like these full out like interpolations inside of our work. It's kind of us doing a cover of like in Daddy, I got to do a George Michael cover, you know, like, and like, I think about how like all of Aretha Franklin's best songs were all covers, or even like in Auntie, like one of the strongest songs is that cover of that Tame Impala song that Rihanna does. And there's something that amazing about having five different versions of the same thing, like, because they each transform in these new ways and tell you something about that person's interiority, even if they didn't write the thing or make the thing. And I don't know.
You know, it's funny, when I think about all these things, what you're really talking about is form that accesses the body, right? Because we really want to just access form, accesses the body, and pop accesses the body. And when you make access to the body, you become present, right? And when you become present, you see things new, or you see things like when I meditate, sometimes when I know like I have a good meditation, is I open my eyes and I look at my hands and they don't look familiar to me. The palms of my hands. And when you suddenly get to see the world unfamiliar through access.
Yeah.
And then through being something unfamiliar, you get access, and then you see things like in a way, I can't even put it into words, but it's just like.
But it's so interesting that you're interested in the body, because your work is also so post-human. You know what I mean? Like, it's like you have this like sort of post-humanism that sort of like translates throughout. You know, you have this interest in dolls and this interest in like tech, you know, in this way that like is so out of the body. So I wonder, like, if like as someone who also has the same investment in bodies, right? Like, the reason everyone's always like, why write plays? I'm like, because like when you write a movie, like, there's no body. Like, you know, like the body is like is like filtered through six cameras, you know, or six lenses. Like, and then like, and I'm far away from the bodies that like watch it. But when I do my plays, like, I'm literally in the audience almost every show, because I get off on like bodies moving differently or responding differently with me, and watching the bodies on stage do it differently and change and like activate in new ways. So like, why objects and not like bodies? Like, why not be a choreographer?
I don't know.
I mean, I was thinking that the effect on the body of the audience is, it's almost like these tools are being developed by you, whether it's colored sculpture or female figure, to sort of have an intense bodily effect by resisting traditional meaning, which I think is something we've talked about too, resisting trying to reconstruct a narrative or address something, a virtue signal. You end up having a very visceral, immediate effect on the person who's seeing it. I mean, that's sort of what those works feel like.
The thing I always had observationally, that I was like, the gallery is a stage that the viewer gets to walk onto. And I always thought about that. And then when I think about when I was in your play, when I was in Daddy, I was like, isn't this amazing that here is this contrived event, completely contrived, fabricated event we're watching, lit, and there's a pool and a house, and we all believe it. We're all in it. And I said, isn't that fabulous that we can have that part of our human experience, that we can get hacked by narrative, hacked by form? And I thought that's an amazing part of the human experience, is that how, like, this idea of representation, like how we are kind of like hacked by representation, is like really compelling.
It's wild. I had this like sort of like this like thing that I was like, representation doesn't matter. Like, I loved saying that, because I felt it was like I hated people telling me that like I had to like something just because like there were black people in it. And I was like, but that's not like, I feel more represented than I am love, in a weird way. Like, I'm like, I am Tilda Swinton eating the prawn. But then I saw like the Spider-Man movie, and I was like literally hacked by that movie. And I was like, representation does matter. But I didn't even know what it meant at the time. But I think about how like, again, it's structure. It's like Annie Baker has this great monologue in The Antipodes about the Antipodes is like a play that takes place in a writer's room. It's really phenomenal.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. I love Annie Baker. We all have like that one like person that people are like, that's your writer crush, or that's your artist crush. And you're like, yeah, like, I know it's weird, but like, I stan Annie Baker. But she's fucking cool. But anyway, she has this plays all around this writer's table, and they are constantly talking about like what makes a story and like how a story works. And there is a whole part where they talk about this guy is like addicted to writing stories, because it's like, it's like the earliest form of like rewiring, technical rewiring, and how like basically like great writers know how to, like, every time they put pen to paper, how to hit that part, and that part in your brain so that you'll feel the things. Mm. And I think that is kind of, because I feel like when I'm writing, I know immediately if something works or doesn't work because, like, I'll get the chill or I'll start to cry or I'll do it. And if I don't, then I'm like, oh, I need to rewrite that scene. And it doesn't matter how many times someone tells me I need to change it because they don't like it or they don't understand it. If I felt it, I know it. Yes. I know it's real.
You know, yes. And that's the difference between a professional and an amateur for me is that we trust the way we see. And when you see my work or when you see Jeremy's work, you're getting a chance to see the way we see. When you see like a Luke Toymans painting or like a Wolfgang Tillman's photograph or a Tino Segal performance, you get a chance to see the way that artist sees.
Yeah.
And you're fucking lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's beautiful. And it's like when the artist can kind of open that space up and sort of let the world push through them, and then it kind of, it basically remains as a kind of freeze that then the viewer can then re-enter over and over and over again.
Yeah. You know, talking about that and hearing about Annie Baker and Toymans, I was curious if you guys would talk a little bit about influences. I mean, sort of like some of the early reading that you did that sort of gets you to the place where you are, sort of, I mean, disruptive reading, whatever it is. I'd be very curious to hear about some of those early inspirations, influences.
Yeah. I mean, I was really, because I was raised by like a single mom who like worked a lot, I ended up being a latchkey kid, you know? So I was in this small town in Virginia, and I got to, like, my mom, like, had been told at a young age that I was, like, advanced. So, like, basically any impulse I had, she would just be like, well, yeah, I mean, they say that that's helps smart kids, you know? And the thing that I used to have to do when I was in trouble was, like, she'd make me read books when I was young. So, like, I, like, became, like, because at a certain point it stopped being a punishment and became, like, fun. It's probably why I have a weird relationship to punishment now. She was like, she would let me go to the movie store and just get whatever movie I wanted. So I got really obsessed with like the Criterion section inside of the movie store and the Blockbuster, and then also just like anything that was like international, because like again, like when you're 12, like watching a Bertolucci film is like both like informative and also porn, you know what I mean? So you're like, but you can get away with that one. Like your mom, you're like, oh no mom, it's Last Tango in Paris, it's famous, it's not like a pornographic film. And so
can I interrupt and just tell you guys my go-to porn as a kid was Trading Places.
What's Trading Places?
The movie with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy.
What is it about?
Because
I'm assuming they trade places somehow racially.
They trade places racially, and it's like this crazy race story, and I was obsessed with it, and it was my favorite movie when I was a kid. You haven't seen it?
I've never seen
it. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it's so funny because I keep getting asked to write these like race trading movies now.
You have to see
it. Yeah, everyone is really into that now.
But there's a scene of who's that actress who's married to the guy who made Waiting for Guffman? Jamie Lee Curtis. So Jamie Lee Curtis is in it, and she plays a prostitute, and there's this part where she changes in front of Dan Aykroyd. Like, she basically, he's, like, down and out, and she, like, brings him to her house, and she gets naked and changes in front of him, and that was, like, the most titillating thing for me, and I watched it, and I would show it to all my other friends, and it was sacred. Anyhow, I'm going to, like, let you...
No, I'm so into that, because mine was so different. Like, mine, like, the film that, like, unlocked, like, my erotics was The Dreamers, which I think is a lot of people's movie, but, like, Louis Garrel in that movie was, like, the sexiest thing to me, but the thing that turned me on in that movie, that I tell people all the time, and they're like, wait, that's so weird, but I was like, I don't know. There's a scene where they're talking about Maoism at the in, like, the movie La Chinoise. And there's like a huge Mao poster, and he and Louis Garrel's, and they're both. It's been raining outside. They've run back in the rain. And they're both wearing these like silk like house robes, which is like amazing. And they're like talking, and at one point Louis Garrel and like they're disagreeing, and Louis Garrel grabs Michael Pitt's throat, and then like slowly slides over, and he puts one leg over his leg, and like his crotch is kind of touching his butt. And I remember that was the thing that I would rewind over and over and over again because I thought it was so hot. But and it always sucks because Ava Green comes in and she's like, "Boys, what are you doing?" And I'm like, "God damn it! Why did she come in and ruin that?"
Oh my god, I have can we like go out of this conversation? I'll tell you a crazy fucking story.
Oh, what is it?
So when I was like 19 or 20, I hung out. There was like this guy. He like befriended me. His name was David Greenberger. And he like He like wanted to hook up with me, but he also like wanted to impress me. And like he brought me to this guy named Joe Smith's house. And like Joe was this like guy who must have been like 65. He was like from Georgia and he like lived in this like loft like around 20th Street. And like everything was like maroon and like they covered all the windows. And it was like so weird. And we'd go there and like smoke pot. And it was just like, wow, we could go there and hang out with this guy. So there were like all of these like weird like things happening because there was like all of these like young gay dudes who were like somehow messing around with Joe. And there was one.
And how old were you at the time?
I was like 21 or no, 20. Okay. And like Joe was like really cool. And actually Joe lent me money to buy a video camera and I like paid him back. But I like, well, I'm going to tell you how, like when I paid him back, it's so crazy. But basically there was this one kid that Joe had some kind of relationship with who started poisoning him with rat poison. And
what?
He started poisoning. So the whole thing was like.
Why did like get money?
To get money from him. And he started poisoning him with rat poison. And then one night, me and Mike Pitt had to take care of him. And I remember Mike Pitt being on the phone. He's like, Joe's dying. Like, it was just like talking to someone like, what are you doing tonight? It's like, I'm at Joe's house. He's dying. And I'm just like sitting here like, what the fuck is going on? And I had this like super awkward night, like eating sushi with like Mike Pitt. And then I remember like stuffing, I'm like, Joe, I'm paying you back for this camera. And I'm like giving him money and like putting it in this like dying man's pocket. And yeah, it turned out someone was trying to kill him with rat poison. It was so weird.
Was the guy like in a will? Like how was he going to get money?
I have no idea. But there was like all of these like spooky narratives going around.
It was found
all
out. It became clear.
Yeah,
what
was so weird. Anyhow, like I sat there with, whenever I hear about Mike Pitt, I just remember this like weird traumatizing night with this like, you know, middle-aged man who was being, you know, he was like actively peeing poisoning on himself. Anyhow, later, Joe actually died in, what is that, Bellevue Hospital a couple of years ago, maybe 10, 12 years ago.
Whoa.
And he lost his apartment, lost everything. He just like had all these people around him using him. It was like really, really creepy and
that's
weird.
Really insane.
It was so weird. It was like right across from that magic store, Abracadabra.
Oh yeah, sure.
Anyhow.
Well, I'm really interested in like this like moment when you were like this twink running around. Because I feel like the thing that always happens whenever I talk about you, people are like, oh yeah, it's so weird. I met him. He's not gay, right? He feels gay. And I'm always like, I don't know.
I'm like, I am a little actually gay. I would like
admit. What is a little actually gay?
I mean, I like
everyone's queer for clout now.
I'm not I wouldn't say it's queer for clout, but like I have hooked up with guys and I have like vibed with guys, but like for the most part I mostly date women. That's like what I really, really love women in a way that I don't or haven't had access to men at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I'm kind of like, I'm kind of open, but women,
like gay adjacent.
Yeah, I would say so. But at the same time, it's that I grew up with a passive father, and I grew up with three sisters, and I grew up really insecure and not like good at sports and not all these things. And I just like don't like straight guys that much. Even as a straight guy, I'm just like, I feel like anxious around you. Like I feel like, whoa, are we like competing? Like blah 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 blah. It's like, and I always found from
it's interesting. Yeah.
I always just found that like I just appreciated my gay friends so much more. And I have always had this huge sense of being like an outsider. And I think I really related, especially in high school, to my friends who were gay.
It's so weird because I have the exact opposite feeling. I'm living on Fire Island right now for these 2 weeks. And I was just like, do I hate men? Like, I was like, I grew up with just my mom and my sister and my grandma. And, you know, my papa was there, but my papa was like very, is my grandfather. He's very, he's like a man of the 50s and 60s. He wasn't forthcoming with like any emotions. And I didn't like that part of him. So I like actually like built up a like sort of personality and defiance of that because I wanted to be more like my mom, like who's charismatic and fun. And like, and so anyway, and when I'm around a big group of gay men, I see so much maleness that like, I'm just like, I can't. And I actually sort of now prefer these sort of like passive, or even some, not even just the passive. I found my voice in like straight spaces. Like I was like, there was a club in Chicago called The Underground. And when I was 18 years old, I like heard about it because I worked at Barney's. And there were all these women would come in and be like, oh, we're going to The Underground, which is like, it was like the hip club. And I was like, I want to go to The Underground. So I got in like my best outfit. I showed up and like they didn't ID me because I was tall. And then like I started going there and like the straight dude that ran the club was like, you are cool. You will have a bottle here anytime you want to come here. So I was like, great. So I became like a personality there. And like then like, and straight men liked me because like women liked me, right? Because like I could talk to any girl. And so like all these straight guys just sort of like had me as like a honeypot for these girls. And I learned in a very short amount of time like how to hang out with straight dudes, how to talk to straight dudes, and how like, and especially straight dudes with money. It was like a thing. And so like even now when I like think about like my manager and like the executives that like I'm working with in like movie stages, I'm like, oh yeah, like I've literally never worked on a, like my agent's gay, but like none of the men who've been like, I want to do something with you, like let's do it right now, have ever been gay. They're all straight. And like I'm like, oh my god, like this person's like my dad. And it's like probably some deep-seated daddy issues for me that I have to work out. But I prefer, I don't know, I have this like this deep joy being around like a bunch of dudes that aren't trying to fuck dudes.
Yeah.
Because I think when even at that party we went to that night, I was just like, I would rather sit outside and smoke and talk to Jordan than like be inside with all these shirtless men who like look at each other like meat.
Yeah.
There's a competitiveness you're talking about is, of course, a sort of straight competitiveness that makes you uncomfortable, Jordan. And of course, that same thing. You have a completely different, if you're interacting with straight guys, it's completely different. That competitiveness is then off the table, right? It's a completely different.
Completely.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is like, if I'm like into a guy, like I'm into like other straight guys like me.
Yeah.
I'm not into like effeminate men.
Yeah.
That's not like who I'll be crushing
on. That's
so
interesting.
Yeah. It's so weird. And it's almost like, it kind of goes back to that porn you're talking about. It's like, that's my trauma.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That's my trauma. But you know what's interesting? It's like, you know, just, I think we have to touch upon this, is that like, Jeremy, you're like making this art form that's like predominantly like witnessed by like Jewish, you know, like monogamous couples over the age of 60. Can you like talk about like what that's like?
It's fucking annoying. I'm excited by like intergenerationality. Like I'm like really interested in like being in a conversation with like a 60-year-old about my play or an 80-year-old about my play. Like one of the best like things that was said about my play was said by my thesis play recently was said by my friend's like 87-year-old like art. Like he met this woman who was like about to fall in the street, and then he was like, oh, you can't be out like this. She's like, what are you talking about? I go out every Tuesday night to see a play. And he was like, well, someone should be with you, like you shouldn't go by yourself. She's like, well, my husband died, so do you want to come? And now they go to see plays together, and she's amazing.
And they met just on the street.
Wow. Like, because he's like, you know, such a gentleman, and he's like Catholic, and so he was like, a lady fell and he like went and helped her. Anyway, she came to see my thesis play, and she was like, it was fabulous, it was this, it was that. And she had the best things to say about my thesis play than anyone else. But working in the theater, the thing that sucks is that like theater is run by people who are also like of that ilk or generation. Like baby boomers run the theater, not just in the audiences, but like in behind the scenes. And like every other industry, I think the baby boomers are trying to like actively kill us by like just not being like, okay, like maybe let's let some new ideas come in, you know? So I think that for me, I see it, but I also like obstacles. And so I think that, like, the whole reason I started writing plays with, like, a sort of fury and fear was because all of my friends were like, plays don't make sense. Like, why would you want to do a play? Like, it's all for old Jewish people or it's all for this type of person. Like, and I was just like, well, no, like, plays can be for you. Like, have you seen this? Have you seen that? And they're like, no, never heard of it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I want to make plays that my friends will fucking come see and we can, and we'll, like, make theater cool again, you know, like, not to be Trumpian about it. And, yeah, I don't know. I mean, if it's a thing that I think other people feel more displacement of in the audience than I do. Like, I think other people who are peers have had like really violent responses to having to sit in a room with the plays I've been writing specifically and see like a sea of white hair around them, white hair that's also connected to white faces, and like they're like they're laughing at that, like that's a weird thing to be laughing at, and like I'm laughing at this, and this is like a thing that they should be laughing at, but they're not, like what is going on? They have this like, and I get off on that, like that disruption, because again, something's happening to bodies, right? But I think that I'm starting to get really interested in ways to like fuck with that moving forward. So like when Slave Play goes on Broadway, like one of the things we're trying to do is like we want to have one night where we just where we get someone to buy out the entire theater and have like a night where it's just black audience members. Like we have a fully black night because I've also like only ever been to like one play that was all black and it was a Tyler Perry play.
What are the demographics when you put it when Slave Play was up? I mean, did you see how was the audience very mixed?
Oh, well, so people, the thing that's funny is that people who are unaccustomed to going to the theater were like, this was really white. But people who were coming to the theater, like Tony Kushner was like, this is the most diverse audience I've seen in a long time. And it's just like, because like we worked really, really hard on getting like people under 30 and like black and brown people into the audience. And so much so that I was literally buying tickets and like just giving them to people. Wow. Like to my own place. I was like, I want to see you here. I'd give people tickets on Twitter. I'd give people tickets on Instagram. Like any way to get them there. If anyone showed like a peak of an interest and the show was already sold out, I'd like buy my own house seats and give them tickets. Or I got friends to buy tickets for people. Like I did this thing called like Rich Friends, and my friend Maxwell ended up buying 30 seats during previews because he was like 30 seats is like basically like the price of a coat. And then I went to a fancy dinner where I was supposed to like shuck and jive for some donors, and I was just like, hey guys, also like reparations are important. And so my friend over there is 30. He just bought 30 tickets for the show, and if he can do it, I'm sure all you guys can. And then they were all like, yeah, let's do it. So we had this like Rich Friends program. So like a bunch of seats were bought throughout the run that we gave out for free.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it got so many people in. But I think that demographics wise, there's still like a lot of work to do because it won't look like an art opening. Art openings, like I don't know what the community did in like 2005 to like rehab everything, but you guys made art cool. And maybe it was like St. Vincent playing at MoMA or something, but like I think people just started like showing up.
Well, what do you think about your audience, Jordan?
Well, I'll tell you. So my audience, I think, is I'll tell you, the audience that purchases my work are probably the same people who go see your play.
Yeah.
For example, or adjacent.
Yeah.
But your work in particular draws in a lot of non-buying audience members to see it, right? Because it's very experiential.
And yeah.
You feel when you go see the work that you have a diverse audience. I mean, I'm sort of, I wouldn't, my gut would tell me actually weirdly not, that it's still predominantly white, your audience. But I'm curious if you feel it's mixed.
I feel it depends on where it is. I think predominantly, unfortunately, the art audience in New York is predominantly white. But if you go somewhere like Amsterdam, for example, or you go into, you know, a city in Europe and you do a show at like at a city museum or a state museum, potentially you will have a more mixed audience. But it does seem...
That's so wild. In Amsterdam, you'll have a more mixed audience than in New York?
In also Amsterdam and Stockholm, potentially. These are places where there was also a lot of like refugees living.
And the museum serves a different purpose, potentially. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just fulfilling a different role. It's not,
And I remember when I was installing in Moderna Museet a couple months ago in Stockholm, and I was taking a little coffee break, and I saw this like school group, and it was like led by this like Swedish white teacher, and I think there was like two white kids, and like every other kid who was beautiful was like Asian, or they were like, Asian, or they were like Middle Eastern, or they were black, and it was beautiful. And I was like, this is how the world should be.
Yeah.
This is how the world should be. And these are the kids who should be here.
Yeah.
This is the way they should be led in.
I was going to ask one thing about, you know, looking at, you seem to have real visual art references, right? Like you're talking about the art world. Obviously, there's a play in which Mapplethorpe appears, Baldwin, that you've written.
Yeah.
And I've seen you at the Gap. I mean, you know, sort of like, and you're here with an artist. I mean, in what way has the visual art world played a role for you? Is it a space for sort of freer imagining? I mean,
I mean, I think it's a grass is greener kind of thing. Like, even just then, I was like, the art world is so diverse, right? And you guys were like, no. And I'm like, oh, cool. But no, I think that I've always had this sort of, I've been attracted to both music and visual art in a very deep way because those are the things you can access in Virginia. Like, really, like, you know, you don't need to go to a great museum to see, like, all the great works of art. You can, like, literally just, like, look in a book. And I think that because I had, like, an interest in things that, like, made me feel crazy. Like, you know, like anything that made me feel like, what the fuck? I could only find in the art world or in the, and also in choreography. So like, it became a place where I would be like, oh, okay, cool. Like I know, cause like, I love theater, but like no one, but this is a problem with the audience. This is one of the reasons I want to fix the audience, right? Like, and the people who make decisions, because like in the last decade, right, there have been like four All My Sons revivals on Broadway, which is like, we all love Miller. Miller's great. Do we need four of them? You know, and yet like people that I really loved, like I could never, I had to engage with their work like a museum, like a piece in the museum. So like, it was like Adrian Kennedy doesn't get produced. Like Adrian is like my everything. Like if someone could do fucking at a like, you know, a movie star only stars in black and white on Broadway, like that would be the thing that would drive me to a revival, right? So I think that like I didn't have access to like the tangible things about her work, you know, how it felt, how it smelled. But I could like watch a video of like Adrian Piper video, or like right. like look at like a Lorna Simpson print and have that same sort of like textured feeling
right.
that I should be feeling. So it became like really easy for me to like make that reference. Because also it like there was something that I realized that in the theater world that if I could because it's also my safety net in the theater world too, is to be like articulate about art, because having an articulation in art forms or spaces that they don't made it easier for me to say why I didn't want to be in the August Wilson play, right? Because like I knew that I wanted to do like experimental theater and like maybe work downtown, and so like when I was in drama school and people were like, okay, Jeremy, here's your Corey monologue from Fences, and I knew that that wasn't the kind of work I wanted to do, I would just be like, okay, cool, like I'm gonna do this, but I'm gonna do this like I saw Ralph Lemon do this one dance, so I'm gonna be twirling the entire time I'm doing it. And they were like, what, this is realism? And I'm like, this is my realism, you know? And then my defense would always be like, you don't know art, you know? So I don't know, I think that it was a safety blanket for me, because also I wasn't doing the assignment,
right?
But it also was where I was able to see myself, because also blackness and brownness are refracted in more or represented, I think, in more exciting ways in the visual art world, because there's just been more license for us to be like, you know, you see William Popel and like you're like, oh, or see Popel and you're like, oh, like that's like, this is the abject blackness that I feel. It's not a sort of beautified blackness that I don't feel connected right. to, or sort of like respectable blackness that I don't feel connected to.
You know what's interesting about that is like, it's like you're piggybacking on art because it like provides you with like a kind of like agency and a kind of freedom. And for me, I feel that way about my friends who are writing fiction.
Oh, wow.
Because it's like there was always that sense where it was like with an artist where it's like, if you do this, this, and this, you're basically telling us you are this, this, and this. And I'm like, no, I'm like trying to approach this as like a kind of author of fiction.
Right. Yeah.
And like, of course, there's parts of me in here. How could there not be? But this isn't me.
Yeah. But I feel you also have looked at strategies in other art forms. I mean, for example, the theater. I mean, I think when I look at your work, even if it's not conscious, right, there's a real sense of sort of audience performer dynamics. There's an awareness of what it means to be looked at as an audience member, right? I mean, your kind of real interest in the visual.
Yeah, and then mostly, really, honestly, it's really of just it's really about tight observation of myself. Like I've really just, it's been a kind of really actually a kind of small world for me, and I've just been observing, like how, like just being conscious and like mindful of my experience of witnessing and how to like reaccess that witnessing.
But that really cool thing you said about, like, how does that interact with the thing you said about, like, a gallery being, like, a stage that the audience is on? Like, yeah. I thought that was so beautiful.
Yeah.
So how does that interact with that? And, like, what does that stage mean to you then if it's, like, less, if it's more about, does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like this idea of, like, the hack of suspension of disbelief, potentially.
Mm. That the gallery's less good at it, or
because no, it's just different. It's just different, and it's almost like when I think about it, like I have this like rule about like no tricks,
yeah,
like no tricks, no illusions, like you see it,
yeah,
like it's just like I just like have this thing, like I remember like looking at these Rodin sculptures outside of the Norton Simon Museum in Pasadena, and it's like, you see them and then you walk around them to a certain point and then you get access to your body looking at them. Mm. or you, for example, like the best example of any sculpture viewing is Michelangelo's David, where more or less 90% of all the angles you look at it is like a kind of A-plus body experience.
Yeah.
And actually, you can find a couple angles that aren't great. And I did. And it's really interesting. And it's really interesting, this idea of access, right? Because people are actually, this all of these things, like all the content and all this and all that and all the flashing lights and whatever, it all just comes down to, like, how do you get, like, into that, like, state of body, and through the state of body open to a state of presence where, like, one witnesses, like, presence with a kind of indifference. And when I say indifference, I'm not talking about, like, a hostile indifference. If anything, I'm talking about, like, an indifference that is indifference, observational. Yeah. But, like, if, like, even through the act of love, we witness indifference. Mm-hmm. Like, we witness indifference for, like, if you love someone so much, you, for a moment in your intensity of your love for them, you see them. Mm-hmm. And so it's like this idea of seeing and this idea of witnessing, and like witnessing through love, and witnessing love, and like love is a portal to like witness, and potentially transgression is a portal to witness. And then one could argue and describe the different qualities and differences of these.
I mean, what's interesting is it's also a bit of like, it's almost like a suspension of wanting in the moment. You know what I mean? When you talk about that calm observational quality, but it's, you get there through a sort of explicit exploration of desiring, of being sort of manipulated, of being, you know, whatever it is that forces you to step back and actually for a moment not want a message, not want meaning, but somehow feel, like you said, embodied or sort of in the moment.
I love this sort of meditative relationship to like, not just making, but like, as you're saying, like witnessing. Because I think that that is the sort of drug that happens in great theater. You know what I mean? You're able to like go to the space of like pure and just like witness. Like I feel like this, everyone's gonna be like, okay, guys, we get it, witness. But no, it's really, it's stunning. And it made me think about like all the types of things that I don't like. And like, and I think where does rage in viewing or witnessing come into play for you? Because I think, because like I always think about like things that are like productively bad and like in not productively bad. Like, you know, it's like I have this whole thing about white nonsense and how like there's like productive white nonsense and unproductive white nonsense. So like productive white nonsense is like Bruce Nauman, because like I'll be thinking about the nonsense of his sense making for like years, you know. But then like some unproductive white nonsense would maybe be like, oh god, I can't say their name.
Say it.
Like a whatever. Lester Duplass Brothers film, right? Like it's like, I feel like that's
what,
like,
is that? I don't know.
Like they're like mumblecore. Like it's like, for me, it would be like that for me is unproductive white nonsense, because it's just like, oh, you had some cameras in Austin and you like made some things, and like I don't know why I need to like be in awe of this like nonsense. Like it's like not a movie. You know what I mean? It's not like Alex Ross Perry, who I think like has productive white nonsense. You know, it's like this whole thing. Because I have this whole thing about how like black people have to make sense of themselves consistently in like representational media. And so like we are denied the chance for nonsense outside of like music and in visual arts, right? Mm-hmm. But like, you know, even now I think that like the demands on like young black artists to like be like perfect art, like the kids who are getting really popular right out of grad school in the art program are the ones who make the most sense of blackness a lot of the times. And even daddy made less sense of blackness for people than Slave Play did. Like Slave Play like told you what sense you needed to make of like a black body in relationship to a white body. Even with the ambiguity of its ending, there still was like a sense of like, oh, I know where Jeremy stands, or I think I know where Jeremy stands in the black white debate. And so I'm like, and the reason why someone like Adrienne Kennedy doesn't get produced is she doesn't have enough like nonsense. But I think that like when I'm sitting inside of something, I get this rage that like is usually linked to it being productive for me, because it's so bad I'm mad that I'll have to like think about all the ways it's bad for a while.
I mean, you talked about really wanting to resist all virtue signaling in some way, and that even when you look at other people writing and working today telling stories, there's this attempt to kind of revisit or reconstruct or correct for, and that you're really sort of not interested in correcting at all.
No, I mean, because I think that, well, first of all, like, so many people have already tried and failed, so it's like, why do this? And I think that what we've seen that has worked a lot, like, sort of in cultural production is, like, people who produce like produce things that like don't dictate, you know, like being didactic doesn't actually help.
Never works.
Yeah, it doesn't. So, and I think that like all you can be true to is like sort of like the complicated mess. Because I think a complicated mess is something you stay with. So, like if you give someone a tangled knot and they're like, "Can you undo this for me?" Like they'll be working on it for longer than if you give them a knot, like a rope, and ask them to like tie a knot
for tell them how to undo it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Here's the knot, and here's the yeah.
Exactly. So okay. I like people being able to, because like also the thing I hate about the theater that tells you exactly what it is that you see it, you get up, you clap, you might have felt something, and then you walk out and you're like, so what are we eating?
Yeah, exactly.
And I was just, and maybe it's because I'm kind of a narcissist, and I was just like, I want someone to sit and think about me for 2 days, you know? Like, it's like that's for me, I think, an important thing. It's like, I want you to be thinking about this play, thinking about these ideas, sitting with it, so maybe you won't make that, like, microaggression the next time, or maybe you will listen to your boyfriend differently, or maybe you will look at your son like a human, or maybe you will, you know what I mean?
Right.
And I think that's and also like I think the dualism comes from I've become a sort of like astrological determinist and I am a Gemini. I'm just like, and I'm a rising Gemini, I'm a like sun Gemini and this Taurus moon. So I think and like Gemini's all over my chart.
I'm a Libra and like yeah, Libra Gemini.
Yeah, I know. It's a
we're
love
so
affair.
Bonded.
I know.
It's a love affair.
I was gonna mention that you were a Libra, but I was like, I don't know how he feels about being a Libra. But yeah.
I'm a special Libra, actually. Why? I'm an October 9th Libra and I had my chart read and they're like, you, for whatever reason, like you're rising. I don't know all the names of it, but they were like, you are not indecisive. And I was like, you're right. I'm generally not indecisive.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So last kind of bigger question is, what is each of you working on next? I mean, you mentioned Broadway. Maybe you just say one or two things about that. What's happening? How did
it
happen?
It's really crazy. somehow my play is going to Broadway, which is really crazy. There were like whispers of it in December. Like that was like the thing. Like, you know, a big producer saw it and was like, I'm going to help you go to Broadway. And then like that fell through and like some things didn't happen. And I was like, oh, that was, and it was so weird. It's like being like, and like, and I was really obsessed with it. And I got like, kind of got sad and like, because, like, literally, it was all of my Christmas break was everyone's like, okay, we're almost here with the theater. We got this much fun. We got this. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to Broadway while I'm in grad school? This is insane. And then, like, the minute I didn't get it, I was like, what? And then, because it's all about real estate. And then I woke up 2 days later, and I was like, Jeremy, you literally wrote this play to be at Abrams. Like, I literally wrote this play to be, like, in a tiny place that I was going to self-produce. It's like, you never wanted to go to Broadway. You don't like the plays on Broadway. Like, why would you go to Broadway? That's psychotic. And then...
And then, of course, it happened once we had that.
Yeah. Then once, and then, like, I got a call, like, 2 weeks later, like, the Schuberts love you. And I was like, great. So so that's going, and it's really, really exciting because I think the only reason to go to Broadway is to try to do something differently. And I think that, like, because we know that... I think because we know that the play is already going to be a thing that's like emotionally taxing potentially, because it was last time when like all of Black Twitter like got confused by what the play was about. That it's I'm just like, let's do it in a way that I can feel proud of, if whether this works or doesn't work. Right. So like almost the entire cast is coming back. We gave an offer to everyone, and there's some scheduling conflicts which make that more difficult, which is sad. And then
wait, can I interrupt you just for a second? How does Black Twitter like react to it? Are they like, have they actually seen it, or are they speculative?
Oh, a lot of people didn't see it, and like someone leaked. So basically, the New York Times doesn't really. The New York Times like comes to take a photograph of your play for like the thing, and like you can't really like art direct them. Like I now know like the things I should have said in that first. Or to the theater to like make clear to the New York Times. But the New York Times posted a picture that I would have never in my life put as like the lead picture of Slave Play as one of their lead pictures in a profile of me. And then someone who really was not happy about the play leaked it to Media Takeout because the picture was of our lead actress with her tongue out and she was twerking in a slave garment and a white man was behind her. And the actress was Tiana and she's phenomenal. But Tiana has like a really big following in the Black community. So Media Takeout, which is like the Perez Hilton of the Black community, was like, y'all see, actually the headline is really funny. Like I actually cracked up when I read the headline. They're like, yo, there's this new play on Broadway and they got a little slave girl twerking for daddy, like, or twerking for Massa. Like, what are we gonna do about this? And then I became a big thing, and a lot of people were like super homophobic, and like it was just like, and everyone kept saying it was on Broadway, and when we were in previews off Broadway, and so like that was like another really confusing thing. And then there was like a petition, and there's this woman who like saw the play, like she was one of the people. She was like, it was disgusting. She like totally misrepresented what happens in the play as well, which made me say to her online like, you're lying. And then she posted a picture of her ticket, and I was like, well, I guess she's not lying, but she also is lying about what happens. Like, so the petition got 12,000 signatures. And so anyway, it was a lot. I got like death threats, like my actors were really scared. So I was just like, if we're gonna go to Broadway, like let's do it like in a way that I think is understandable. Let's try to make tickets cheaper. Let's try to do like cool parties. Like we're gonna try to have like a party, a bi-monthly party.
Nice.
Like,
when does it happen? When is it actually going?
October we open, September we start previews.
Okay.
But yeah.
Very cool.
It's really insane.
That's amazing. And Jordan, we know you're cooking something up.
Yeah. But, I'm working on the third animatronic piece.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Does it have a name yet?
Kind of. It does have a name. I'm thinking of this. I don't want to say it here. I'll tell you guys when we're off mic. But yeah, it's actually officially kicked off June 21st, officially. And yeah, that's what I'm doing. And that's what I'm doing for the next year and a half.
Wow. Top secrecy.
Top Secret.
No leak. No leak.
No leaking. Camp. No leaking.
You guys, that actually
I leak
the title, Top Secret.
Yeah,
actually, I will gush and leak off microphone. Yes. But the, it's the third animatronic. I'm really excited. And
I can say I've seen some things about it, and it's amazing.
Did I send you the film I made about it?
You might have. You sent me a lot of things. Okay. I watched like two of them.
Okay. Yeah. I'll send it to you today. But yeah, and then I've got this body of work about JFK Jr. that I've been doing for a year.
Yeah.
And I'm continuing that. I'm actually making this really large hologram sculpture with about JFK Jr.
What is it about JFK Jr.? I'm sorry.
It was kind of like, for me, it's kind of the only way I'm trying to look like through JFK Jr. Or like, it's like looking at that corner in the room to like talk about the corner just above my ear, you know? So it's like it's kind of like, how do I talk about the world without talking about the world?
Right.
In a way.
On that note, the world talking about the world. Talk about the world without talking about the world.
And yeah, I just want to say, I'm so grateful that we got to
sit
here.
Amazing.
I'm like, I adore you, and I am your fan.
Shut up.
I support your work.
I'm such a fan, and it's like actually crazy, because it's like, it's also so validating. Thank you for inviting me too, because like I love art people. It's like, you guys have better brains.
There's nothing, for me, there's nothing better. Like, for me, like all the success, like for me, is just about knowing other creative people. Yep. That's where I feel so much. I'm so grateful to be where I am, because I get to get access to people like Jeremy. I'm so excited.
And spend time with him, yeah.
I have a real question for you. Because like, I'm thinking about doing something differently soon. Like, I think I want to write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, like, you seem to have, like, a brain that jumps around a lot, too. But you've stayed pretty, like, in the art lane.
Yeah.
What other space of creation might you go to if you were to go to
that? I had Hollywood, you know. Hollywood knocked and invited me. They've come around. But I'm kind of like, I really asked myself, like, why I would do it. And I think, like, I for a while, I was just like, oh, I'm in L.A. And I just, like, I want to feel, like, important in Los Angeles. And I was like, that's not a good reason to, like, work in this field. Like, and I'm just, like, really interested in sculpture.
Wow.
And art.
Yeah.
And it's, like, I kind of just accept that it's, like, a small field, you know? And I'm like, yeah, but it's just, like, I'm, like, really obsessed with art.
Yeah,
and I kind of surrender to it. It's just like, whatever. It's like, I'm taking out ambition. I'm just like inserting intention. Mm. And that's where it's leading me, you know?
I love that.
Yeah.
That's really lit. All right. Guys, thank you so much. That was amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucas.
Dialogues is produced by David Zwirner. You can find out more about the artists on this series by going to davidzwirner.com/dialogues. And if you liked what you heard, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It really does help other people discover the show. I'm Lucas Werner. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you join us again next time.